more than just the headlines. Hey, it's 11:08. Hello again, everybody. Welcome back. I'm Jim Altoff. Thanks for tuning in to News Talk Radio, King 1090. Some signs of a little improvement in our weather out there. The haze is a little thinner, and we're actually going to have some sunshine today. Boy, hold the front page. There's some news. A pretty nice afternoon. Partly to mostly sunny today. Highs in the low to mid-60s. Let's enjoy it because the rain returns tomorrow, by tomorrow afternoon, and we'll have rain Wednesday through the weekend. Right now, 56 and still overcast out at Boeing Field. All right, finally this morning, we're going to shift gears a little bit. I think it's about time, too. How many of you have ever thought of really getting away from it all, of packing it in and just moving to some island somewhere for a year or two? I suppose most of us with that fantasy would imagine some South Pacific paradise. Most of us with that fantasy will, of course, never come close to actually doing it. But my next guest this morning did take off for an island for a year and a half. Wasn't exactly Tahiti. In fact, it was Alaska, Swanson Island on the Inside Passage. How he came to head north and what he found there are the subjects of his new book. Welcome now to Michael Moduleski, the author of Inside Passage, new and published by HarperCollins. And Michael, good morning. Welcome to see
morning.
You.
How are
you?
Great. Thanks for having me on.
Appreciate your time. Really fascinating stuff. You really bring it to life up there. And for those of us who think about this stuff but never do it, that can mean a lot. How did you come to do it? This didn't really all start with Jeremiah Johnson, right, and a desire to just get away from it all. Is that how people do their lives?
Well, sometimes you read a book or a movie that's totally pivotal in changing your future. And I was living in Aspen at the time and went to see Robert Redford's movie, Jeremiah Johnson. Came out of there and wondered if I could possibly live in the wilderness as sort of a rookie and learn from it in the 20th century, because there were a lot of mountain men running around in the 1880s and 90s in the Rockies. And was there a corner on the earth anywhere where you could go into wilderness and have those similar experiences?
Why would you want to live in the wilderness? Was there something to prove? Was it, gee, am I capable of doing this? Would I like it? Did you want to get away from what you had? Was it an escape? Was it
a
challenge?
Well, I felt that I would learn things about myself. That when we live in the city or an urban environment, it's sort of never tested, never used.
Yeah.
That we have a lot of qualities, and we did most of our growing up as man, you know, out in nature. So this has been sort of a recent development, living in the cities and that.
Yeah.
So I sort of wanted to go back to the source and test myself and see what would come from that.
Well, you found some tests, I'll tell you. But why north? Why not somewhere a little more hospitable? I mean, if you had to get away from it all, why not the South Pacific somewhere where you could just lie on the beach and suck on coconuts all day?
Well, you know, it's funny because I love the weather in Seattle. In fact, I don't like when it's that sunny because being a writer, I was looking for an environment, and I think Ingmar Bergman, the film director, had an island somewhere in the Arctic Circle off of Norway, and he loved when it was sort of the chiaroscuro skies, and it's sort of easier to create and turn inward when you're not distracted by...
When the sun's out, you go play, right?
Right.
When it's
yeah.
gloomy, you stay in and write.
Exactly.
Right. All right.
So, the weather was sort of an influence.
Tell me about this place, about Swanson Island. First of all, how you found it, how you came to the circumstances that brought you up to the Inside Passage in this remarkable spot that you lived.
Well, I came out of Jeremiah Johnson and sort of sent the vibe into the universe, you know, that I want to find wilderness.
Mm-hmm.
And then about 3 weeks later, an architect, a French woman from Vancouver, came down to attend the International Design Conference. And we met just by accident. And she said, come up and visit. And I did. The last night before I was to leave, she got a phone call from a friend that owned this island. Mm-hmm. He came into town. We went out for Chinese food. And he just painted with words the same paradise pictures I had imagined, as far as the island I wanted to live on.
Yeah.
Before he left, he said, before you go home, why don't you hop on the ferry and come up and see me? I cracked open my fortune cookie, and it said, you are going on a journey to an exotic land. Who could resist from that?
So you said, all right, you go up and visit him. Where is Swanson Island? Tell us about located for us.
About 220 miles north of Vancouver.
Okay.
So it's right off sort of the northeast tip of Vancouver Island.
Uh-huh.
And 3 miles long and about half a mile wide. And the first day I got there, there were two kayakers from Seattle that were paddling all the way up the Inside Passage to Alaska.
Uh-huh.
And Will Maloff, the owner of the island, was out fishing. And Doug asked me if I'd ever kayaked. I said no. I went out in his friend's boat. We went right over a school of salmon. A bald eagle cruised over our head. A black bear popped out of the woods and was trying to grab a salmon out of the ocean. And, you know, there's 8,000-foot mountains coming straight out of the water. And I said, this is the place.
Okay, yeah. So you decided this is where you wanted to spend some time. How did you do that? What did you have to do to make the arrangement so that you could be there?
Well, then basically I was, Will had never been able to leave for an extended period of time for 9 years that he'd been on the island. So yeah. Basically I was the caretaker. Mm-hmm. And then the first winter he disappeared for 67 days.
Yeah.
And the storms up there are ferocious. So my first winter, and I wasn't prepared for this, but I went for a little over 2 months without seeing another human being.
Didn't you get horrible cabin fever? I mean, the accommodations were not exactly palatial either. And humble, serviceable, but humble.
Right.
You're up there alone on an island a half a mile wide and 3 miles long, all by yourself in the dead of winter. Didn't you go nuts?
Well, at first I didn't because here there's always a telephone ringing or there's noise around, and I really got into sort of listening to voices within and also learning from the animals. But a strange thing happened is when you see old movies about the sourdoughs, they're always mumbling to themselves, yeah, or singing songs, and I hadn't spoken out loud during that entire time. I was reading books and thinking, but I should have mumbled or, you know, sang some songs, because after the 67 days, some Indians came out and hit the beach,
yeah,
and I went out to say hello. And my brain fired the words, but my tongue, it's like any other muscle. If you break your arm and have a cast, it atrophies. And I sounded like I was drunk.
Yeah.
And I invited him in, and they were looking at each other like, God, this college kid isn't going to make it. You know, he's already in the sauce.
Well, they told you, right? I'll be back in a month to pick up your bones.
Right. And they, and I had a big box of books right there on the daybed. You never have time to read, like, Ivanhoe and Moby,
yeah,
Dick.
Yeah.
And they looked over at that box of books, and they said, you're going to stick those in your wood stove just to keep yourself alive this winter.
Yeah.
And he said, you have all this knowledge, but you don't have any wisdom. And we'll be by in the spring to collect your bones. So then, that was the low point. It was like, gulp, what am I doing here? You know. But then I took it as a challenge, and I said, well, if Jeremiah Johnson could do it, why couldn't Michael Mojeleski?
But that was a movie, Michael. That was a movie. I was just kidding, right?
Yeah.
We've got to take a break. We'll be back with Mike Mojeleski, the author of Inside Passage. And as we proceed, I want to make sure that you understand you're welcome into this conversation. Maybe you have questions about life in the Inside Passage on an island. You want to talk about your own experiences getting away from it all in the wilderness, back to the earth, roughing it, however you would care to characterize it. We're going to talk about some of the remarkable creatures that Michael ran into up at Swanson Island and some of the fascinating people and cultures he encountered as well. 441-KING is the number. That's 441-KING. Statewide and toll-free, 1-800-833-KING. And if you have a cellular one phone in the car, it's a free call. Just dial *1090. It's 11:16, and we'll be right back.
The King News Talk 1090, guide of places to go and
world have Goodyear written all over them. So what are you waiting for? Sale ends June 1st.
11:18, back to Michael Mojeleski, Inside Passage. A lot of wildlife up there. I guess that sounds pretty silly to you, but some phenomenal encounters you had with some of the animals there. Eagles, for instance. Lots of eagles. And it's the females who were the aggressors, huh? The females who were the hunters.
Right. If you would get anywhere near the nest, the male would, being shy, would sort of fly away, and the female would sort of dive bomb you if you were, you know, climbing a tree or getting anywhere close.
Mm-hmm.
And
these animals have amazing eyesight.
Yeah, there's been studies where they can actually see an 8-inch herring on the surface of the ocean from a distance of a mile and a half to 2 miles away. So it's like having built-in binoculars or zoom lenses.
Mm-hmm.
And during the herring runs in the springtime, when the herring would come through there and just mass tonnage, the eagles would come down and actually catch one fish per talon, you know, and they'd fly away
with one in each.
Yeah, with one in each hand, you know.
Tell me about the orcas. Magnificent creatures, huh? And you got a chance to see some a lot closer than most people ever will, I think.
Well, luckily I had a kayak that, in the shape from their perspective underwater looking up, looks very sort of dolphin or whale-like to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
So, and without an engine making a lot of noise, they didn't feel threatened. And about a week before I left, I was actually able to make contact where a big female came about an inch away from the side of the boat, reached out my hand. She actually spouted, and I, you know, could breathe a breath. And then I reached out my hand, touched her on the back of the dorsal fin, and sort of felt her muscles quiver, almost like a handshake as
Weren't
well.
Weren't you a little frightened? I mean, this is not a little tuna here. This is a big mammal.
Well, the worst and best of times was I was underwater scuba diving about 20 feet down,
yeah,
and the ocean is so clear there that you can see about 120 feet. and it was high noon, and all of a sudden the lights went out. And I looked up on the surface, and there were two orcas that had just put the brakes on the surface. And with their sonar, they picked me up down below. Mm-hmm. And I had a 3/4-inch black wetsuit on that makes you very rounded. And other divers told me that if you're afraid of the whales and you want to chase them away, put out your arms and wave your hands, because no seal or sea lion has hands that far away from his main body. So the whales dove down, and they swam tightening circles around me. I had about half an hour of air in my tank, which I burned up in about 2 minutes.
Because I'll bet.
My heart, adrenaline, I was going crazy. Because when you see a 30-foot-long, you know, orca swimming by, the dorsal fin on the males is 6 feet tall. And they have these big, beautiful, lucid blue eyes that were shifting back and forth. But the circles were getting tighter and tighter as they swam around. So finally, I put out my arms, waved my hands, and they both took off. But then I went on a magic carpet ride, because their flukes underwater created this wave that just knocked me backwards for about 50 yards.
We have this idea that these are beautiful, noble creatures, and they are, but they are also killers. I mean, these are what the Indians call them, water wolves or
right,
something. This is not Flipper out there.
They deserve to be called killer whales. The common name now is orcas. It's a lot less threatening. But from that perspective, the killer whale is at the top of the food chain in the ocean.
Yeah.
It eats everything, and nothing eats the killer whale. So that's how smart they are, and they also hunt in packs like wolves.
They even take on blue whales?
Right, down
the
in
Baja.
The
largest creatures on Earth, these things gang up on them to go for what?
And they rip out the tongue of the blue whale, which is like a delicacy.
Yeah.
But the tongue on the blue whale is, I think, the size of a Volkswagen.
Yeah.
It'd be, you know, a bug or whatever.
But they'll attack a blue in a group and manage somehow to get its tongue.
Right. A couple whales will swim in and sort of bite the blue in the stomach.
Yeah.
And, you know, again, from our perspective, it might seem cruel, but it's the law of the jungle and nature.
Everybody's eating everybody out there. We understand that.
But
weren't you worried about being attacked? Will these things attack humans?
Well, there's never been a documented case except for two loggers that were working on a hillside in 1956. And one logger deliberately torpedoed a pod that was swimming down below by sending logs down this chute.
Yeah.
And the story goes that the two loggers later in that day were in a boat paddling back to their camp. The killer whales came back, upset the boat. Both loggers fell in the salt chuck, but only the man, only the man that was doing the actual torpedoing was attacked, and the other logger was left unharmed. And this is a documented case. Dr. Paul Spong with Greenpeace in the Orca Study Program up there has done the research on it.
I know these creatures have big brains, but how smart are they? Couldn't they? I mean, you suggest it might be they're more intelligent than humans.
That's a tough one, because the way to find out is to communicate.
Yeah.
And John Lilly right now is using computers and trying to break down dolphinese and somehow, but until we can bridge that gap. But I think their intelligence is totally different. You know, their brains are bigger than ours, and people say, well, the bigger the body, the bigger the brain to need it, you know, to move it around. But actually, they have a bigger brain in the general association area, which in us functions as memory and thought, you know. But until we can find out, you know, exactly what they are thinking, it's tough to find out or measure that.
Let's get on the telephone here. There's some headphones, Michael, hanging right in front of you there on a hook, if you'd slip those on. Michael Moduleski, the author of Inside Passage. We're talking about his experiences on Swanson Island up in the Inside Passage. If you have a question, comment, experiences of your own, you'd like to swap stories here, swap tales, give us a call at 441-KING. Francis, good morning. You're on King 1090 with Michael.
Hi.
Hi there.
I just wanted to share, I wasted my youth making the world safer democracy.
Uh-huh.
And I spent a lot of time in the South Pacific.
Yeah.
Close to the ocean, a foot off the ocean. Hmm. And we were, just had our noses rubbed into the wildlife out there in the surf. The only recreation besides drinking would, you know, it's scuba diving, or just floating around in the water. The place is just, especially at sewer outfalls, teeming with life.
Mm.
And it is, they are scary. Actually, I've never had anything to do with large animals, but things like moray eels. You know, you lift up a rock looking for a cat's eye, and a moray eel jumps between your legs. It's really scary.
Well, Micah, you ran into quite a few other creatures as you were diving. Wolf eels, is that what they're called?
Right.
What's a wolf eel?
Well, it looks like imagine a jack-in-the-box with sort of razor-sharp teeth.
Ugh.
But They're naturally shy, and the only reason they will bite you is if you're, you know, probing into their lair with your hand, or if you surprise them. And as with most animals, they're, you know, grizzly bears or killer whales are not at all aggressive toward man,
yeah.
Unless you know surprise them or corner them or come across, you know, a mother and young.
Mm-hmm.
But 99% of wildlife is afraid of man. So there's usually, you know, no problem up there with being attacked by the whales. But it's just the sheer size. When you're underwater and you see 30 feet of, you know, pure muscle. And orcas are so strong that they will go up to seals and sea lions. And a sea lion can weigh as much as a ton.
Mm.
And they will slap it 20 to 40 feet up in the air and play with it like a cat with a little mouse to stun it before they actually eat it.
Yeah.
And that's how powerful they are.
Well, sea lions also have been known to attack, right? I mean, we've got sea lions around here. Oh, aren't they cute and blah, blah. These are not necessarily the most gentle creatures on the earth either, are they?
Right. I had a diving buddy that was underwater. He was doing a solo dive, and he was the recipient of amorous advances from a female sea lion.
Mm-hmm.
And she wasn't exactly subtle. She knocked his face mask off and pulled out his regulator.
Come here,
and,
you. Yeah.
Yeah, so he had to actually run away and break the date.
Yeah.
So, you know, but it was all in fun, and she wasn't, you know, malicious or trying to kill him or anything like that.
No, she just wanted to have his cub or have his have his pup or whatever. What about an octopus? You were prowling around diving and came up with a nice story about an octopus.
Yeah, and where you live in Seattle, it's the giant octopus is right offshore here, the largest in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd be out snorkeling or scuba diving, and I saw one that was about 12 feet across. But one of the most graceful and beautiful creatures that would actually change color as it was moving over the ocean floor. And when it spotted me, it settled down on the floor, mm-hmm. and I couldn't find it. Mm-hmm. It turned into this mottled, sort of brindled brown color and just disappeared. And then it slipped into a lair that you could barely slip your hand into, but they're just like elastic
no bones.
Creatures.
Yeah. A lot of advantages to no bones. Weren't you frightened, though? Weren't you worried about all the movies you saw as a kid? I'm sure we saw the same ones where the octopuses got you and pulling you down.
Right,
and all
you know, the devil fish. And
yeah.
I think when you're with wildlife long enough, you realize that Hollywood to sell tickets. You know, there was a big movie, about 8 years ago called Orca, where,
yeah.
you know, Orca turns into a cross between Godzilla and King Kong and eats, you know, half of the Western seaboard or whatever. But,
yeah.
you know, and it's sort of a disservice, especially to kids in schools, because they see these movies in Jaws and they think that, you know, every shark or orca is a man-eater and malicious. And, you know, it's good for ticket sales, but it's really not the truth.
All right, we got to take a break. We're going to catch up on the news. When we come back, we're going to talk about some of Michael's encounters with the Indians of Swanson Island and the regions around the Inside Passage. And if you have a comment, a question, an experience of your own you'd like to pass along, you're certainly welcome to give us a call at 441-KING in Seattle. Statewide and toll-free, 1-800-833-KING. Stay tuned. There's more to come.
Ah, springtime. It's finally here, and those longer days mean more time to enjoy the things you love the most, like a springtime barbecue with your friends, your family, and the fresh flavor of Peterson's Fryer Farms chicken. Peterson's chicken, it's grown right here in Washington, so you know you're eating the freshest chicken around. And of course, Peterson's grows them naturally, without hormones, without preservatives, so it's wholesome and healthy from the farm right onto your barbecue. So why not stop at your grocer's for the chicken that grills up crispy and juicy and enjoy Peterson's chicken tonight. Look for the consumer hotline on every package of Peterson's chicken and call for barbecue tips, recipes, and nutritional information.
11:34. Good morning. I'm Jim Altshuler, along with Michael Moduleski, the author of Inside Passage, a travel adventure story and more than that. About a year and a half that he spent up on Swanson Island and the Inside Passage. I want to ask you, Michael, about the Indians of the region, help me out,
Quakutl.
Quakutl Indians, all right. Quakutl Indians, the most artistic of all Indians, you write, huh?
In fact, Edward Curtis, who was commissioned by J.P. Morgan and the president, back at the turn of the century, did 20 volumes on North American Indians. And the biggest volume he devoted to the Quakutls because of the totem poles. And they had so much wealth around them as far as, you know, the salmon that they could smoke. Mm. So that their winters, they basically weren't taken up with any hunting and gathering. And they had this incredible, they put on theater in their longhouses. And almost everyone was an artist or an artisan. So.
They had a funny idea about possessions, too. They like to give them away, right?
That's right.
They would accumulate all this wealth.
It was the potlatch, and the sort of it was a way of waging war without anybody getting killed as well. And I'm sure any bankers out there are listening. It was sort of a high interest loan where you would invite the neighboring village over and sort of wine and dine them for anywhere from 1 to 2 weeks straight, and give away all your possessions. And then, but the party had to be thrown back, and even in a bigger and more lavish form. So they said that, you know, possessions really should be on the move, that you shouldn't just accumulate things and put them in a museum or whatever, but that they should be traveling around all the time. So it was kind of a good economy that way.
When you first came into contact with the Kwakiutl Indians, they didn't exactly match what you had in your head, right? I mean, you're thinking like anybody, you know, traditional. You find these people in split-level homes watching soap operas on colored TVs and leading what would appear to be very mundane suburban lives.
Well, I was shocked because, you know, I was coming from the perspective of the Curtis photos of 1890, also Franz Boas, a cultural anthropologist. I read his stuff. And I expected to arrive in Alert Bay and in the neighboring islands and somehow be in a time capsule and see the Indians in the old ways. But they were, you know, living very much the way white people do, except for the Indians on the outer islands that were trying to keep their traditions alive. And those were the ones that I learned an encyclopedia set full of knowledge as far as, you know, how to catch fish and how to look over your shoulder when you're traveling in the fog, just to look at the silhouettes of the island tops. So when you're coming back, you can find your way home, you know, that way. And, you know, on and on and on from the techniques they'd build up.
We'll talk about fishing in a bit, but I want to know more of your views about these Indians and the loss of their culture. I mean, you mentioned, this isn't a sociology book, but, I mean, you mentioned problems with young people, with alcohol, with drugs, with unemployment, a real feeling of loss of old ways and old cultures, but you also seem to find some hopeful news in that. I mean, is that just your hope that there is a new Indian, there's a new interest in old ways?
Well, there's
is that
definitely,
really happening?
Definitely a renaissance. There's more carving going on now with totem poles and also seagoing canoes. The young people are picking up the language. The government in Ottawa returned a lot of the stuff that was confiscated from Alert Bay during the potlatches when they were outlawed. So that's been returned, and the condition was if the Indians would build their own museum, which they did, and it's in Alert Bay, and it's just a fantastic longhouse that houses, you know, their cultural history. So, in fact, a lot of museums now are even returning back to the Indians throughout North America, you know, things that are important to them and their religion and that. So, in fact, one incident happened to me where a Kwakiutl couple asked if I would babysit their kids who were 8 and 12. And I learned more from those youngsters in, you know, having them for half a day than I think I did with anybody else up there. So that was very, very heartening that the new generation still knows where to go and catch the salmon and a lot of the language and their traditions.
But isn't it a relatively small number of whether it's these Indians or members of other tribes who are living that far from civilization that they can sustain the older ways? I mean, all these skills don't do you much good if you're living in a reservation setting. I mean, what are you going to, you know, so you know how to find your way around in a canoe and how to catch salmon, and that's not what you do. I mean, it's just...
But up there, they sort of have the best of both worlds because they, you know, they'll have comfortable houses and they have good health care, but they're out there on those salmon boats, especially during the summertime. And then during the winter, you know, they'll go out and hunt and things like that. So they do leave the home, and you can go out on that water. And it's funny, but a lot of people think the Inside Passage is really sheltered ocean because there's all these little islands to break up the waves.
Nice and calm and safe.
But what it is, for anybody that's lived up there or traveled, it actually acts as a wind funnel. And a lot of the wind will come across the continent, you know, of Canada, and it sort of turns north. And I've been out there when it's absolutely beautiful, and 2 minutes later, you're caught in an 80-mile-an-hour gale. It can change that fast. So I think they do have to tap into those old resources when they're out on the water and, you know, fishing especially.
Do they fish commercially, the Kwakiutl? Are they fishing for their own needs?
There's some very, very wealthy families that have built up a string of purse seiners, the big boats that go out. And it's amazing, but when the king salmon are running through there, they can make anywhere from $30,000 to $50,000 in a 20-hour period.
Yeah.
So the wise ones, you know, make a lot of money and then reinvest it back into the business and add more boats on for their children to work and that. So, you know, it's they're fishing commercially, making quite a bit of money.
Is the industry pretty healthy up there? And do you get a lot of people from here going up? I know an awful lot of people from the Puget Sound area go up and fish halibut, salmon, whatever's in bust their hump for a couple of days or a couple of weeks, and that's their year's income.
Right. I mean, yeah, and it's controlled and licensed, and you know, they'll only give out so many new licenses every year because they want to keep that delicate balance and make sure that there's enough fish for the long haul.
There was a certain irony in when you were dealing with some of the Kwakutl people, and you remarked, here's so-and-so sitting in his house watching as the world turns and eating chocolates, and here's this scraggly young white guy who doesn't want any of this and can't wait to get back out to the wilderness, back out to the woods. That's an interesting reversal. Did they think you were a little screwy?
They did, and it really surprised me because when I went to see Norm, and we walked in, and they had Hallmark card scenes on the walls, and they were watching, you know, As the World Turns and eating chocolates. And I had to go to the bathroom, and I'd used an outhouse, you know, where I could watch bald eagles flying, and it was totally comfortable to me for, like, over a year. And I went in and flushed the toilet, and I was in there too long just looking at this contraption, you know. And I came out, and I said to Will Maloff, who was with me that day, I said, Will, they have a toilet, you know. And I was, like, excited about something that, you know, we totally take for granted. And the Indian couple looked at me as if I was some wild animal.
Yeah.
So I walked out of there going, wow, it's just a total role reversal. You know, here's a white guy that's a savage, and the Indians are getting civilized.
Michael Modzelewski is the author of Inside Passage, published by HarperCollins, Living with Killer Whales, Bald Eagles, and Kwakutl Indians. And if you'd like to talk with Michael, if you've had experiences of your own, maybe to the north, you're welcome to give us a call. Lines are open at 441-KING, statewide and toll-free, 1-800-833-KING, star 1090 if you have a cellular one phone in the car. All right, why did you leave this paradise?
I had left, I was there a year and a half, and I wanted to write this story because so much had happened to me in 18 months. It was like an accelerated lifetime. And I wanted to get into a situation where I could find an agent and really sell it and try to market it to most of my abilities. And I also took slides, pictures of that world, and I traveled all over the United States showing, giving assemblies in grade schools.
Yeah.
And the kids just loved this part of the world. I mean, all of you people that live in Seattle, just count your blessings. You know, people say it's cloudy and everything else, but it's really, truly paradise here. Because the kids in the urban areas, I would go in black schools in Oakland, and they would actually run up just to touch the screen to try to, you know, they knew it was pictures, but just to try to make some sort of a contact with this kind of wild world. So I did that with the pictures. But the strangest thing was, is I should have left the island and gone to a halfway house.
You went right from Swanson Island to...
I went to Miami Beach, of all places.
Yeah.
And... it was strange. I was like a Sasquatch. I had a bunch of wool clothes and long hair, and I stayed in an apartment with the drapes drawn watching reruns of Charlie's Angels and The Price is Right just to get acclimated back to, you know, that culture. So if I would have done it again, I would have gone to Mendocino or a Montauk.
Work your way in a little bit. You gave in the book two reasons in Inside Passage, Michael, why you left. As I recall, sunshine and sex, is that
well,
about
you know,
that?
The
I mean,
women,
it's a little lonely up there, right?
Women are an endangered species that far north.
Yeah.
You know, I think it's something like 10 guys for every one gal.
Ooh.
And I went to Miami to look up an old flame. And,
Also, and to get a little sun.
Right. Further north, too, we would get about 120 inches of rain a year. So I just wanted to, you know, get back to the sun and also to tell the story.
Let's go to the phones. Susan on a cellular phone. Good morning, Susan. You're on King 1090 with Mike Modzelewski.
Yes, good morning. I have a very good friend who is a registered nurse and really actually stayed with the Navajos in Arizona. And this doesn't have anything to do with the Northwest Passage, the Inside Passage that you're talking about. But I would like you to comment on how I'm sure that you experienced how well the women were treated in the Indian culture. They have their own separate language, basically, from the men. And it seems to me that the civilization, as you're talking about, has lasted so many centuries because of, I feel, the way that the women are treated are just, it's really unbelievable. I'm not sure if you ever experienced that or not, but, I mean, after they've had a baby, you know, they're taken away and they're treated beautifully, or during the certain types, in terms of their month, they're taken on big mats of moss and taken care of. It's a beautiful way that they nurture their female cult, you know, female species, if you could say so. In every aspect, they treat them that way.
Yeah, I observe the same thing, and thanks for calling in with that. And the Kwakutls are very much a matriarchal society.
Are they?
And the shamans and the ones that are sort of the keeper of the knowledge and the special wisdom are female. And I read the other day where men tend to treat their women in any culture as they treat the earth. And there was no accident that the environmental movement and the feminist movement, I guess, started at the same time.
Right.
And the reason why the Kwakiutl culture has lasted so long and they've been in harmony with nature, I think, is that there's a balance that sort of the male machismo, you know, to sort of divide and conquer never really got into a runaway emotion there. It was always balanced by the feminine and respect for the earth.
Right. And when I see these people on, you know, down on First Avenue, these Indians, we have so much to learn just from these people here. I really believe we do. And I really believe so much has been taken away from them. It's sad.
Yes, and I think that they are. They're the teachers. And as, you know, there's more and more environmental devastation, I think that we turn back to them. A good friend of mine here in Seattle at KCTS, John DeGraff, a film director, did a film on called The Moon's Prayer that's full of a lot of the Indians' teachings and wisdom. So I think that helps a lot.
Don't we risk, this sounds terrible, Michael, I'm sure, but romanticizing Indian culture and as the font of all wisdom, as the source of learning and lore, when you look at least some of the culture of Native American peoples, you see a lot of bingo parlors and souvenir stands, a lot of alcoholism and unemployment, terrible things. A culture that looks like it's just holding on. That's a very sad thing.
Right.
But then we talk about this also as it's this high culture, this advanced culture. We have so much to learn from it. Do we?
Well, I think we do. But there are good Indians and bad Indians. Some of the worst people I know there's some terrible Indians, just like white people and Polynesians and human nature being what it is.
Sure.
You know, but like Dances with Wolves, I was talking with Peter Matheson, a nature writer, and he said he loved the movie, but he felt that the Indians were stereotypical. One tribe was totally good.
And one was totally bad.
And the Pawnees were the villains.
Yeah.
When in reality, you know, the Dakota Sioux were some of the fiercest warriors, you know, on the planet.
Yeah.
So I think that, you know, there are a lot of people that sort of over-glamorize the Indians and make them into saints. And they themselves will admit that they're people. You know, but the fact that they have a tradition and they've been in this country and living on this earth.
They have a history that we don't have.
Right, and, you know, we showed up with our ancestors maybe 200 years ago.
Yeah.
With European attitudes, whereas, you know, they've lived here for millennia. Mm. So I think that definitely is listening to.
All right, we've got to take a break and right back to your telephone calls. Michael Moduleski, the author of Inside Passage, Living with Killer Whales, Bald Eagles, and
Kwakiutl.
Kwakiutl. Indians, 441 King is the number to call.
Remember your high school graduation? It's doubtful you...
...station serves the Seattle King County area. This concludes this test of the emergency broadcast system.
11:50, right back to our guest, Michael Moduleski, the author of Inside Passage. Let's go to Marysville this time. Hello, Bill, you're on King 1090.
Oh, Jim, nice to talk to you. First time I've called you specifically, and the main reason is because of Michael and his book and... in the island. I traveled up there for almost 20 years. I've been as far north as Barrow to as far south as Ketchikan from the Aleutians to Barter Island.
Hmm.
And I traveled up there a lot.
Are you a fisherman, Bill?
You bet.
Yeah.
The main thing being is that there's a lot of wilderness up there, and the natives do have a great chance to use those experiences and the knowledge of the old ways. And the further north you go, the more there is of it, and a lot of them are keeping it up. And I appreciate this man's living in the wild for a year because I've done it for a winter, and it's insanely quiet.
Doesn't it just drive you nuts? Don't you just go crazy for a TV set or a tape recorder or something that makes some noise?
Human.
Humans?
Noise.
Yeah.
Yes.
Human noise. And yes, it can, and yes, it does, and it did almost. Hmm. And I found out that a lot of it, because I too went up there to Alaska originally with the idea of cutting my little section out of the woods, you know, and doing that sort of thing. And I found out that I can't do that. I do need a movie theater from time to time, and I do need a restaurant from time to time, because it's that human contact that I never did get while I was out there, and Michael knows what I'm saying.
Michael, do you think you could permanently make your home at a place like Swanson Island? Or would you need to be able to come back and forth?
I think
to Vancouver
back and,
or
I
Seattle
think back and forth.
Berkeley, yeah.
And I think that a lot of people are natural nomads anyway.
Yeah.
That it's very hard for us to live in one place and not travel.
Mm-hmm.
You know. But I know. Thanks for calling in because I know exactly that feeling of that silence. You know, you could actually hear your heartbeat or your breath going in and out. It would
and
be that.
And the bugs
kind.
Buzz in the woods.
Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, nice talking. To
nice
you.
Nice talking with you,
Bill. Thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you this morning. Flora is next in Seattle. Good morning, Flora. You're on King 1090 with Michael.
Thank you for taking my call. I've never called in before, but I had an unusual experience back about 30 years ago, In 1962, I was a guest of a friend at Orcas Island.
That's beautiful.
Just off East Sound area there.
Yep.
He gave me a rowboat, I guess, what, are they 8 or 9 foot long?
Mm-hmm.
And I had my salmon gear along, and I went out trolling for salmon. I was alone in the boat, and I drifted out a little further than I had planned to go. About that time, I heard this snorting alongside the boat that sounded like a horse blowing.
Mm-hmm.
And I looked to my right and saw this huge, long, brown back. It was longer than the boat, I know.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't hesitate. I pulled in the gear and headed for shore.
Hmm.
And my question is, was I in danger of having the boat upset? My friend Bill said that they could have come up under the boat. Would they do that?
Normally not. Sometimes there's been cases where big sailboats that have a keel, a big daggerboard underwater, that killer whales have actually, they look at that and wow, without having any hands, it's a great place to scratch their backs. And I mean, you have a 30-foot long animal with that much muscle that's underneath your sailboat, you know, and boats have actually been capsized, not in the North Pacific, but orcas are all over the world and they have knocked boats over. But even if, you know, they had knocked your rowboat over, they wouldn't have, you know, wanted to attack you or anything.
They wouldn't
like
have
that.
Bothered me.
Although
no.
They could have swallowed Flora whole, essentially, right?
Yeah. But, I mean, the great thing is about the Pacific here, there's so much to eat, you know, in this. The killer whales are just, they can catch salmon enough to fill a belly in, like, you know, two passes. So there's no real need to feel any danger. But
at that time, we hadn't heard much about them. In fact, I'd never heard of them in Puget Sound, and I've lived here since 1920.
Huh.
And, since then, of course, as in recent years, we hear a lot more. A
lot of sightings, a lot of spottings of them. Flora, thank you very much for the call and for your story this morning. I appreciate it. Let's go to Jacqueline this time. Good morning. You're on King 1090. Jacqueline?
Oh, I'd like to ask you if you read Patterns of Culture by Ruth Bader Ginsburg.
Yes, that was an excellent book.
Well, then what I want to know was did you find the Kwikutl Indians, the way she described them?
The older generation, very much so, very much like Ruth Benedict.
They really are, huh?
Yes.
But the younger ones are more placid, is that right?
Well, but see, some of the younger ones are realizing the beauty of their culture, so they're seeking out the wise ones, that they call them the elders, to learn from and listen to the stories. You know?
Yeah, I've wondered about that so much.
Yeah, because, you know, as teenagers get, it's like sometimes the older they get, they realize the smarter their parents have suddenly become.
Yeah,
you know, and it's happening with the Indians as well.
Oh, yeah.
That's good to hear.
Well, I want to thank you. I think this is very interesting.
Oh,
thank you
for
very much, Jacqueline. Let's get another call in this time. Brent, is it a... no, Brent's not there. Brent was at a payphone, and his quarter just ran out. Glenn, good morning. You're on King 1090 with Michael Moguleski.
Hey.
Actually, no. I'm afraid he's on a cellular one phone. I'm afraid the reception just isn't going to get it. Sorry for that. Brent is, okay, he's back on his payphone. Let's try there. Brent, good morning. You're on King 1090.
Hi, Jim.
Hi.
I had a question, and I wanted to make a comment, and I'll take my answer off the air. And
okay.
The question was, I wanted to know how he planned this kind of move up to the north, you know, what the logistics involved, you know, how he financed it and funded it to get himself up there, and how one would do something like that. And then the comment I had to make was regarding his killer whale sightings, and I'm a diver, and I was diving one time by the ferry dock there in downtown Edmonds and snorkeling along the surface and heard this big inhaling, just this big sound behind my ear, and I turned around and there was a big, just this huge sea lion, like not 3 feet away from, I mean, I could have touched him out with my hand, and he was just kind of on the surface looking at me with his big old brown eyes and those big teeth, and it surprised me for a second, but I thought, well, I mean, this guy probably sees divers, you know, 300 days out of the year, and so he's probably used to us. And so then it was just kind of intriguing, and I went in under and watched him swim for a while. And so I was wondering also if he thought that the animals in this area were more used to seeing divers and such, whereas up way up in the Northwest Passage, they would be more apt to think of you as a game animal.
As lunch, yeah. All right, we don't have a whole lot of time. You want to respond? First of all, the logistics of this whole thing, how you got up there.
Sir Isaac Newton, the scientist, said that oftentimes a person that really makes great discoveries is the one that has naive eyes, isn't overtrained or a specialist. And I definitely was. I had no background in science, and I was an English major. So I went up totally naive. I didn't really budget. In fact, when Thoreau wrote Walden Pond, he kept track of every penny he spent. And for the 18 months I was up there, I spent a grand total of $240. There was that much food around. In fact, the Kwakutals have a saying that when the tide goes out, the table is set.
Yeah.
You can actually forage around the rocks for clams and crabs and things like that. So to go out into the wild, you really need to sort of have inner riches rather than a big wallet, you know, to really survive.
And how do divers in waters up there, are they treated differently by sea lions, whatever else? Are they less used to them and are you more likely to get a bite taken out than you would be around here where there's a lot of people diving?
Yeah, they're very used to seeing people. And actually, the further north you go and the wilder the animal, the less trouble you would get into.
Huh.
But the more divers they see, and maybe divers are trying to play games with them or throwing something at them, and it's just like in national parks, you know, there's more bear attacks within a
confined
area.
In a park, there is in the wilderness.
Yeah, but the further north you go, you might have animals that are curious about you, but there's less and less attacks.
Michael, I appreciate your time. It's been very interesting. I think Inside Passage is a terrific read, and I wish you good luck.
Great. Thanks a lot. I'm going to be at Elliott Bay tomorrow night at 5 o'clock.
Tomorrow night, Elliott Bay Bookstores.
Come by and say
Michael
hi.
Moduleski with Inside Passage.
For centuries.
Then, to my board of directors, you wouldn't have a job.
That's right. Well, but, yeah, I don't know. The movement at that time, I think, needed you and needs you now in the club. As you said in your point nine, that if only the club didn't occupy so much of your own life, you'd be able to get on to an autobiography. But it does, you said, and I can't. And just as the club has occupied a lot of your life, so too the club, I think, owes a lot of its character to what you brought to it. So
sorry,
memos like this, hell, we can't ignore or toss you out. I just brought this copy of This is the American Earth into this, as you and I have discussed before. This is your first exhibit format book, one of your creations. And when I was 20 years old, this is the thing that got me interested in the environmental movement. I saw that and took the book to my college counselor and said, how do I work in something like this?
And that was my major achievement.
Your major achievement in my eyes, certainly, but not at all.
But the one thing that this does remind me of is when people say the environmental movement started with 1970 Earth Day. I say, I like to say that part of it started when this became an exhibit. And that was 1955, and it took a year to prepare it as an exhibit, but this was a different look at the environmental situation from anything that had been going around that time. This was a completely new look at it. And
the exciting and challenging part of this book to me is that it talks about the role of the human being in the Earth cycle. While it has stimulating and beautiful pictures, it talks about poverty and overgrazing and the role of culture and civilization in planning for the Earth and strip mining and urban development and Los Angeles with the line, hell, we are building here on Earth.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, I
went to Los Angeles.
Yeah, but it did. And as you know, I went on with that sort of line to become an urban planning professional. Saying, whoa, this is something that is worthy of devoting one's life to. But then to mix interracial inequities with social justice and economic imperatives with the celebration of the beauty of the landform. It is a different way of looking at it, and very few other environmental books, particularly picture books, have been so successful in merging all of those concerns.
It worked then. I think it will still work now. I hope we're getting somewhere on bringing a new edition out.
We have it's a real problem. As Foreman has said, here we've become a $28 million corporation with half a dozen or a dozen different departments and offices in 15 states, and we've just bought a new office building in downtown Washington, D.C., in addition to this headquarters, and just the burden of caring for the administration of such a corporation is a diversion from, or can be a diversion from the mission of the organization.
Well, speaking of administrative details, when is the party for the opening of the Washington building? I might not be there.
You will be. You will be.
And
we're probably going to be moving in October, November, something like that. Just I think just before the election,
uh-huh.
And after after the congressmen are out. Oh yes, it's a, you know, it's not a fancy building, but it's one that we can be proud of. It's got a beautiful open.